It has been established that persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder.
Believe in ghosts?
First simply disappears, the other two died.
It's your host, Ashley Lana, and we are back for another episode. How is everyone doing? I'm losing my voice, so bear with me. As always, I wish every single one of you a happy, happy, happy day, especially when we go into dark cases like the one we are doing today. If you are a returning listener, congratulations on being initiated into the Fear Cult. We discuss and break down and piece together true crime, horror, and the paranormal. So, with that being said, welcome to Lullaby. Last week, we discussed the porn-obsessed serial killer Grant Amato, who traded his family's life for his own lust, and he got a one-way ticket to an iron penitentiary. Good for him, good for him. This week is all about every parent's absolute worst nightmare. We are discussing the disappearance of a child, and this case took me 2 weeks to research, and it is a tour de France, so please pay attention to the case. This is a WOW episode, which means a worst of the worst atrocities for those of you who are new to the Fear Cult. These cases are harder to hear than most for graphic and sensitive reasons. We're falling into the deep web territory here, so get comfortable. Because sweet dreams are made of these. The following story contains subject matter involving graphic descriptions of kidnapping, crimes against children, including sexual and physical assault, and is not suitable for everyone. Please take into consideration that some topics may be disturbing for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. It was an absolutely beautiful day to be playing football in the park with his friends. All the 11-year-old boy planned to do was to become one of Portugal's greatest athletes. His initial plan was to go for a drive with his best friend Alfonso, but since he had a tutoring session in less than 2 hours, he had to cancel, and he went to the park to play close by. Then the sound of a muffler caused the boy to stop chasing the ball, and he looked over to see a black car parked near the road. The window rolled down and he seen a familiar face. Rushing over with a smile on his, he began talking to the person. The three boys playing football looked over at their friend as he yelled that he wasn't coming back. The boys watched their friend enter the vehicle and speed away. The boy left his bike on the side of the field. That was the last time they ever saw their friend. This is the true story of the abduction of Rui Pedro. Rui Pedro Teixeira Mendoza was born on January 28, 1987, in Lousada, Portugal. He was the oldest of two children, born from Manuel Mendoza and Filomena Teixeira. Rui was 11 years old, and he had a younger sister, Karina, who was 8. Rui was an extroverted young boy, whose parents described him as creative and the life of the party. He was caring and would do absolutely anything to help everyone around him, even animals alike. Rui's dream was to become a professional European football player. Rui suffered from epilepsy and had to take medication. Other than that, he was an active, healthy boy. The loving family had many friends, and no one had anything negative to say about the Teixeira Mendozas. On March 4, 1998, Rui's mother, Filomena, was working at the driving school located close to the family home. It was around 2 p.m. when the bright-eyed Rui Pedro burst in through the office doors with a smile beaming from ear to ear. He asked his mother if he could spend the afternoon with his friend Alfonso Diaz. Filomena was busy, but told her son that he was not allowed and should instead go play at the park behind her work until his tutoring lesson at 5 p.m. that day. Although disappointed he couldn't spend time with his friend, he accepted his mother's decision and left the building, waving goodbye. It was 6 p.m. when Filomena had gotten a call from Rui's tutor, wondering why he had not shown up for his lesson. This came as a shock to the parents, since it was unlike Rui to miss an appointment. Panic sparked, and the family called the police and reported their 11-year-old Rui Pedro as a missing child, and the search immediately began. A community member came forward and reported Rui's bicycle laying on the edge of the field at the park located behind the driving school. The police and firemen searched, but found no further evidence, until three boys, Rui's age, and other reliable witnesses approached them. They informed the officers that Rui had shown up to the park and had joined them to kick the ball around. It was after a few minutes when a black car had pulled up next to them and hailed Rui over. They noticed that the two were friendly, and Rui had gotten into the vehicle, and it sped away. The police asked if they recognized the driver of the vehicle. All three boys confirmed, the man who took Rui Pedro, Alfonso Diaz. Alfonso Diaz was a 22-year-old truck driver who had become close friends with the Teixeira Mendoza family in 1995. Alfonso had received his driving lessons and permit from the driving school where Filomena had worked. During the time frame, the family had considered Alfonso a friend and trusted him. Filomena had felt sympathy for Alfonso's family, who was struggling financially. The Teixeira Mendozas helped him any way that they could just to be kind. This created a brotherly friendship between 11-year-old Rui Pedro, who admired 22-year-old Alfonso Diaz. Rui's father Manuel didn't particularly agree with the friendship due to the age gap and the smoking habits of Alfonso. The two were limited on their time spent together. However, Rui's parents allowed Alfonso to drive both Rui and his 8-year-old sister Karina to school. The friends of Rui had told the police that lately Alfonso had become slightly obsessive over Rui. He would ask Rui's friends his location and his schedule, which verged on possessive. This worried the friends. Filomena had told the police that the last time she had seen her son, he had asked her to go for a car ride with his friend Alfonso Diaz. The police had confirmed witnesses state that Alfonso Diaz was the driver of the black Fiat car and did let Rui into the passenger side. Alfonso's mother also told police that the car belonged to her, but on March 4th, 1998, she allowed Alfonso to take it for its mandatory 8-year inspection. When the police followed up on the lead, the inspection agency confirmed that there was an appointment for a black Fiat registered for Alfonso Diaz. However, Alfonso did not show up for the inspection. The police brought Alfonso Diaz in for questioning, where he denied taking Rui, but admitted to stopping at the park to have a talk with him. He stated that after he drove to a nearby mall and walked around for the rest of the day. The interrogation became emotional for Alfonso when Rui's cousin Joel Mendoza told the police that on March 3rd, the day before Rui was abducted, Alfonso had told him and Rui to meet him at the park behind the driving school so he could take them to meet a local sex worker. Joel explained that his mother told him that he could not go driving with Alfonso, so he did not go. Media circulated photographs of 11-year-old Rui Pedro through every outlet. A woman named Elsina Diaz, who was a sex worker in the area, went to the police, saying that she had seen the boy, but did not identify the man that was in the car. Elsina informed police that on March 4th, she was approached by a black Fiat, driven by a man and young Rui Pedro, who the man claimed to be 14 years old, not 11. The man offered her money to have sex with Rui. Seeing that the young boy looked upset, she accepted the money and led Rui into the bushes. She spent that time trying to calm him down, telling him that nothing bad was going to happen, and she asked him if his mother knew that he was there. Rui shook his head no, tears falling down his face. He told her that the man in the car was his uncle and wanted him to sleep with sex workers. She stayed with him for 15 minutes until they went back to the vehicle, and that was the last time she had seen Rui Pedro. When the police questioned Alfonso Diaz with this information, he emotionally started breaking down and told the police, quote, "Close the borders." The police, unfortunately, were not convinced that Rui was abducted. They believed that he had gotten lost and that he would eventually come home. And although it was important, there wasn't much of an urgency to locate him. And this is where Amber protocols are unbelievably critical when it comes to finding missing children. So the first 72 hours in a missing persons investigation, these are the most critical. Each passing hour substantially decreases the chances of finding the person. So the first 48 hours are the most important for collecting the evidence and following up on the leads. The longer that the time passes, the chances of witnesses jumbling or forgetting information that are clues increases. According to a criminology professor by the name of Dr. Michelle Ginez with the ABC News, she said, quote, "Investigations on missing persons who authorities believe may be vulnerable, such as children and those with mental illness, are expedited because time is of the essence to get the word out to the public to look for them. Although stranger kidnappings are very, very rare, children are usually murdered quickly, sometimes within the first 3 hours, but usually within the first 2 days. As scary as it is, investigators, after the first 48 hours, their objectives change, and it switches from searching for a live person to locating a dead one. That's how it goes. That's why the first report of a missing persons is critical. Time is of the essence. And Amber Alerts, for those of you who do not know, they are specifically designed for children who are in immediate danger who go missing. And it originated back in 1996 after the abduction and murder of 9-year-old Amber Renee Hagerman. And at the time, there was no immediate way to announce nationally that a child was missing immediately upon being reported. And because after 72 hours, the odds get slim of ever locating the child, it's important to report it and get the message out as quick as you can so investigators can find the missing persons. So with Ruy Pedro, the police, they didn't launch an immediate protocol because they believed that it was just a simple disappearance and not an abduction. And the parents informed the police and media that he suffered from epilepsy, which helped the importance of the case, but not quick enough. And when it comes to Amber Alerts, every country has basically the same protocol. And something that I thought was interesting, and it actually makes sense to me, is these protocols are set into place because if every single time someone was reported missing without looking into the actual background of it, we would be getting Amber Alerts all the time. And then that increases the chances of nobody even caring because they're always going off. And now, especially nowadays, we have Amber Alerts that go off on our phones. And I know people who think they're annoying now and they barely go off. But if they were going off 6 to 10 times a day, this is just for instance, nobody would even think twice. So I understand the strange balance between it. With the case of Ruy Pedro, this poor child, but we're gonna get to that. So weeks had passed and the Teixeira Mendoza family had been receiving prank phone calls from people claiming to have Ruy for ransom. Psychics told them that their son was dead. And there was even a call received where all Filomena heard was a child on the other line just screaming for their mother. And she genuinely believes that that was Ruy Pedro. She believes that that was her son. The police, they were no help and they didn't investigate the calls and they didn't look into any of the leads. And the police did have their phones tapped, but they didn't look in any of them. So the family, they didn't give up and they felt that they had very little support from the authorities. The police, they stopped looking into Alfonso Diaz because he claimed that he was innocent and they had nothing to hold him on. And 1 month following the disappearance of Ruy Pedro in April, a political commentator by the name of Nuno Ruggiero was with his family in Paris, France, and they went to Disneyland. And you can Google this photo. While on the ride, he was with his family and he was taking photographs. And in one of the photos, there is a boy who looks exactly like 11-year-old Ruy Pedro. And he is seen sitting next to an unidentified 40-year-old man whose face is half hidden. And the Portuguese police took the photos, but they found nothing to go on because the man's face was covered. So this is where the story branches off. So I need everyone to stay with me as I explain this because this is crucial. We are now going to jump back 2 years before the disappearance of Ruy Pedro. back to 1996, and we are now in Southern California, United States. Okay, let's continue. It was April of 1996 in Greenfield, California, when 10-year-old Allison was excited to go to her friend Mary Riva's house for a sleepover. The two were always together and had sleepovers frequently on weekends for years. Lately, Allison had been coming home in an exhausted and irritable mood. Allison's mother, Cheryl, explained to her daughter that if she didn't stop acting so moody, then she would not be able to have sleepovers at Mary's house anymore. One day, when Allison's mother, Cheryl, was working around the home, she got a phone call from Mary's mother. Mary's mother explained that her husband, Ronald Riva, was arrested for child molestation, and that she should speak to her daughter, Allison, to see if she, too, was a victim. Cheryl responded in disbelief, having no idea that this was happening. She said that she would ask Allison, but did not think anything would happen, but she would let her know. Ronald was a 36-year-old ex-correctional officer who was currently unemployed. He threatened Allison that if she told anyone, she would get hurt. When Allison's mother, Cheryl, asked her if she was molested and explained what the term meant, Allison just crossed her arms and said, "Nope, nope, nope, I am not a victim." Still feeling shocked by the whole idea, Cheryl hugged her daughter and left the room. Later that day, Allison was to go on a school trip, and when Cheryl realized that her daughter had not come out of her room, she went to go check. As she opened the door, she seen her 10-year-old daughter, Allison, curled up in the corner of her bed. Cheryl knew at that moment that her daughter was a victim. Allison told her mother everything that Ronald had made her do for the last 3 years. Warning, the case details from here on out are very disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. It was soon uncovered that Ronald Riva had been encouraging his young daughter to invite her small friends over for frequent sleepovers so he could groom them for his own. In the Easter holidays, Allison had gone over for a sleepover, and Ronald had pulled her away from the other children. He led her into the computer room where he had a webcam linked to the internet and logged onto a pedophile chat site and proceeded to sexually assault her. Over 12 men were watching in 4 different countries while typing in requests for him to perform sexual acts on her and for him to force her to do to him. Ronald Riva was arrested and sentenced to over 100 years in prison for his crimes. But that was not even the beginning of the nightmare of what the authorities were soon about to discover. When the local detectives raided Ronald Riva's house, they discovered a variety of photo shoot cameras and equipment for broadcasting live videos on the internet. Ronald's computer files were all scanned, and there were over 10,000 homemade child pornography photographs, transcripts, and videos saved. The files revealed that Ronald Riva had created an invitation-only chat room for pedophiles called the Orchid Club. It was on the Orchid Club where he and others would trade photographs, take requests, and sell child pornography. The Orchid Club had a total of 16 members, and Ronald had his computer automatically save everything that happened over the site. It was because of this the authorities were able to find the other members. During the interrogation, it was discovered that on occasions, Ronald would have an accomplice come over to his house during his daughter's sleepovers, and one by one, they would take children into the computer room and broadcast their actions live. He invited his friend, 54-year-old Milton Lee Myers, who had a history of sexual assault charges, one where he spent only 1 month in prison. Milton, however, was never listed as a sexual predator, so the community had no idea of his past. Ronald attempted a plea deal to lower his sentence. He then identified all the members by logging on so that detectives could watch the real time of what was happening over the platform. They witnessed the organization of members wanting to meet up to film each other performing acts on young children and considered them celebrities, and the children were like movie stars to them. During one session, they witnessed men sending requests to a live broadcast, abusing a 5-year-old girl while 11 men watched. The immediate real-time dialogue was overwhelming for the officers, but they needed to find all of those responsible to be held accountable. The detectives were able to track down members by tracking their internet IP address to link their internet service providers. With that information, they were able to get their email addresses, names, and geographical locations. With the help of Ronald Riva, they were able to identify 16 members of the Orchid Club. They were arrested and charged for the distribution of child pornography and exploitation of minors. 11 were from the United States, one from Finland, one from Canada, and the final from Australia. The police confiscated all of the computer's evidence to find the Orchid Club had a grand total of over 50,000 child pornographic images and videos that were being traded like collector's cards. Finally, the detectives were able to shut down the first operational online pedophilia ring as they watched the members sentenced for their crimes. As the investigators were doing a final sweep of the evidence collected from the online chatroom transcripts, they noticed that some of the Orchid members had accessed another separate, private group online based out of the United Kingdom. The group was known as the Wonderland Club. In October of 1997, the police in Hastings, United Kingdom, were alerted by American Customs about 28-year-old computer technician Ian Beldock. Ian's email address was in the Orchid Club's list of members. The Sussex police raided Ian's home, which was located near a school, and confiscated Ian's computer. The forensics team uncovered a personal library of child pornography that amassed more than 42,000 photos and videos, four times larger than any forensic investigator has ever witnessed. Ian Beldock had distributed over 1,642 images to 17 other pedophiles in 6 days prior to his arrest. For 5 months, investigators dissected Ian Beldock's computer. This is where they uncovered the Wonderland Club, a sophisticated and extensive private group of online predators. The group had a chairman, a committee, and specific rules. This is where shit gets fucking heavy. So this organization is absolutely disgusting. The Wonderland Club was created as a private network for international pedophiles to rape and torture children as young as 2 months old and broadcast it. And they treated children like baseball trading cards. They meant nothing to these people. These images were not just of children being raped. There were thousands of videos of children and babies physically being tortured and tied up and chained to walls with their limbs spread apart, which just resulted in horrendous acts, and it was all documented over this Wonderland Club. The group was created in the United States, but it gained worldwide popularity, and the Wonderland Club is spelled with a zero, replacing the O, and this is to make it more difficult to find. And yes, the name Wonderland Club is based off of the children's book Alice in Wonderland. It's just so gross. It's disgusting. It's really disgusting. The creators of the club, they knew exactly what they were doing was illegal, and so they took every precaution to Fort Knox the shit out of their club. And there was a chairman, a committee, it was invitation only, and this boggled my mind. There was an entry fee, and the entry fee was $10,000. I'm going to say this again. 10,000 new or self-made pornographic images or videos of children. Let's put this into a bigger perspective. If the group had 5 new members in a day, that's 50,000 brand new images of children being uploaded to the internet and distributed worldwide forever. And the reason it was of photos was because it was leverage. Like, if you tell anyone, we'll tell the police that you have these images. Now, Detective Chief Inspector Alex Woods from the National Crime Squad said, quote, "The worst kind of possible abuse you could imagine. I have seen images that are the most horrible. Children in nappies being abused, people committing vaginal and anal rape on children as young as 6 and 9 months old. These people are serious sexual offenders." The club operated out of an encrypted chat room where all the members had to use screen names to hide their identity. And the more content you produced, the higher your member ranking was. To make it worse, if a member themselves was doing the acts with the child, they were considered celebrities. And members wanted to meet them and even wanted to visit the children in the videos and play with them. It's just, I watched fucking interviews with some of these ex Wonder Club Wonder Club. I don't even want to get it right. I don't want to give them that fucking acknowledgement. The Wonderland Club. These interviews with these fucking monsters, they're so oblivious as to what they were doing was wrong. The only reason they knew it was wrong was because it was so heavily encrypted. I'll get to it later. So as much as I want to beat the hell out of these people right now, and I'm sure a lot of you guys do too, we can't, because being a good Samaritan and a good Samaritan beating doesn't hold up in court, so don't do it. So report it and let the authorities go to town, and the inmates in prison, well, they can have them. Let them at the inmates in prison. So to log onto the Wonderland Club, a member had to pass 7 security checks, as well as 2 electronic bots that prevented non-members from entering. And the chat rooms were monitored by members as well as a bot. The room itself was encrypted. There were multiple rooms, and each one was encrypted with different codes. And this entire club was locked down. And as I said, I was watching interviews with former members of the Wonderland group, and this is what they had to say about the group. Quote, talking was great. You'd make friends and you'd say, oh, I found this new picture, this great new picture. And they would say, oh, well, what's it called? And you would tell them, and if they had it, they'd say, oh, well, I've got that one. But if they didn't, they'd say, oh, send it, we'll have a look. I will be quoting this source a lot, and he is a fucking monster, and I will call him the Wonderland source. He went on to explain how there are people like him who do not see or believe that sex and sexual acts on children are bad. Only society deems it unacceptable. And the reporter questioned the ex-member on how he found trading sexually explicit images of children not to be morally wrong. And his response was, well, if that's how you choose to look at it, then it is. I think it's time for a hanging. Okay, moving on. In April of 1998, the National Crime Squad took over the investigation of the Wonderland Club and named themselves Operation Cathedral. Their purpose was to track down the UK members of the club. The electronic trail from the Orchid Club directed investigators to a house in Stockport, Cheshire, England. They seen the images of a 9-year-old girl being abused by a member known by the screen name Jazz. The detective soon realized that 3 men were the top leaders of the club. They would even meet with prospective members to screen them to make sure that they were right for the club. If they thought so, then the Wonderland Club would vote if the person would be allowed to join. It was a cool spring night in Stockport when a neighborhood mother received a phone call from her 9-year-old daughter, Lucy. A man named Gary Salt would have his daughter invite her friends over for sleepovers, and he would sexually assault the girls in his computer room and bedroom, exactly like Ronald Riva back in California. When Lucy called her mother, she informed her that she wanted to stay the night again so she could, quote, play games with her friend, and that she was not coming home. Lucy told her mother that she loved Gary Salt more than her. Lucy's mother demanded that her daughter came home that instant and threatened Gary that she would call the police if he did not return her daughter. Gary Salt did bring Lucy home, and Lucy began to tell her mother of all the sexual and physical assault that happened over the course of several months in that house. Gary Salt was a 36-year-old taxi driver and former Air Force engineer, and was considered to be the chairman of the Wonderland Club. He also had children of his own. When the Manchester police arrested Gary, they recovered more than 20,000 pornographic images and videos on his computer, as well as a noose in the corner of his room, in case he got caught and wanted to commit suicide. Gary was more than just the chairman of the Wonderland Club. He was an abuser in his own right. He would film himself participating in sexual acts with multiple young children and would trade them online. The Wonderland community seen him as a star. Another member of the club was named Anthony Skinner. He had the screen name Satan. Along with 3 other members, they would travel to Gary Salt's house to meet the children they seen in the movies, to abuse them and take photos with them online. Anthony Skinner had advanced encryption on his computer, so the investigators were only able to uncover 390 pornographic images. Anthony was sentenced to 18 months in prison. When Gary was arrested, the investigators had a breakthrough. they now had a key member of the club at their disposal to identify other members. The setback was, now with the news of Gary's arrest, the current members of the club became more aware of the security within the website. To reduce his sentence, Gary agreed to aid the police in accessing the Wonderland Club with his information. The CIA agreed, and expressed without Gary to unlock the security checks, it would have taken over 400 forensic investigators and 44 years non-stop just to unlock the high-tech encryption of the site and to reveal the members. The investigators were now able to watch the chat rooms live over the internet, but they had to be careful not to alert any suspicion within the club, which would result in members fleeing and never being caught. Gary Saul pled guilty to the creation and distribution of child pornography and was sentenced to 12 years in prison in 1998. Now that the forensic investigators had full access to the club, they sought the help of the internet providers of the accounts. The electronic data provided the names, addresses of the members who held those accounts. Although the police had the names and the identities, they needed proof of who specifically was at the computer at the time of the pornographic trading. Over the course of 6 weeks, the investigators monitored 13 specific addresses across the country. The police were tracking Ian Baldock's computer, who was arrested back in October of 1997 in Hastings. Ian was currently out on bail and he was still living by the school, and he would take his bike or the train to work. The police were monitoring him at his job and from his computer at home. He was always online and he was back engaging in the Wonderland Club. The lead investigators explained the balance of risk assessment for the case and the children. They faced the difficult task of having to move slowly to catch each member without getting caught themselves. Detective Chief Inspector Alex Woods of the National Crime Squad said, quote, "The risk to children was a constant risk assessment. We would do it where we would analyze whether the particular person at that particular time had access to children, whether the intelligent picture around that made us believe it was as such, and we couldn't actually let them stay at large any longer." The investigation was led to Dartford in Kent, southeast London, to a home of 24-year-old Gavin Seegers, who went by the screen name Spank Daddy. Gavin was a computer consultant and a volunteer youth leader for the Sea Cadets. The police realized that he had contact with 25 children. Gavin and Ian Baldock would have frequent chat conversations about Gavin going to the swimming pool and touching 11-year-old girls in swimsuits. This was encouraged by Ian Baldock. While online, Gavin constantly discussed his fantasy of abducting, torturing, and raping children. The police soon seen him admit that he wanted to murder a child. This was a critical moment for the investigation. Gavin was an active member who was officially a high threat, but due to his constant engagement on the Wonderland Club, it would alert all members if he was arrested. The police decided to heavily monitor Gavin everywhere he went, specifically when he went to volunteer. The instructions for police were, if Gavin at any time was with one or two children, he was to be immediately arrested. It was now 8 months into Operation Cathedral, and the investigators were able to track down 10 UK members. Although great news, the team also uncovered 180 other potential Wonderland members in over 12 different countries. Detective Chief Inspector Alex Woods of the National Crime Squad said, quote, "We could have adopted the attitude, we'll just deal with the people in this country and we'll be done with it very quickly. It would have been all done and dusted a lot sooner than it was. But in truth, that would not have been the way to go forward, because obviously every one of those images represents a disaster to a family. And we decided that we would go forward by getting as many countries on board with us so that we could maximize on our evidence." The British investigators contacted the American police to explain the severity of the Wonderland Club and the 90 suspects in the United States. This marked the largest organized online child pornography ring the United States had ever seen. A U.S. Customs computer forensic expert named Jim Fortrell was given all the screen names of the American Wonderland Club members. Very quickly, Jim was able to identify a key American member who lived in Missouri, who traded child pornography with other members, including his own father. His name was Scott Allemeyer. He was considered to be a high-ranking member since he was a producer and would produce special pornographic requests. When he was eventually arrested, the police found in his home explosives and self-made child pornography with an 8-year-old girl. They even recovered child panties that were hidden in his house. As the investigation continued, the identities of Wonderland Club members soon unraveled. They included a professor from the University of Connecticut, law students, and medical students, one specifically who worked in the children's ward of the hospital. One was a medical student who attended Chapel Hill College in North Carolina, United States. He had close interaction with the children's unit of the hospital. His name was William Rosa, a 31-year-old future doctor. The investigators monitored the daily activities of William Rosa and mapped his day accordingly. He would go to work, then return home to his girlfriend, and then would lock himself into his room and spend the entire night downloading and trading child pornography from the Wonderland Club. He used the screen name Amy, and this was because he knew as a woman he would be able to get access to more content for free and have more trust as a female. And it proved successful. William Rosa's computer held over 70,000 pornographic images of children. William pled guilty to the trading of child pornography. There was no proof that he molested any children, and his sentencing was in February 1999. So far, the United States alone had 14 members that were arrested and 4 committed suicide. The National Crime Squad in the United Kingdom was working with Germany as well. Captain Holger Kind of the German Crime Squad led the investigations. They soon identified German club members. One trail led to a government guest house in Bonn, Germany. The man went by the screen name Ultima, and his occupation was a government senior civil servant. He was a high-ranking member of the club who had a say in who got accepted into the Wonderland Club. In August of 1998, members of the Wonderland Club began getting suspicious. The members began encrypting their photographs, which made investigators realize their time was running out. They needed to act fast. If one member notified anyone, it would cause a hailstorm of members deleting their pornographic evidence and their accounts. The National Crime Squad, with the aid of Finland, the United States, Australia, United Kingdom, Austria, Belgium, Italy, France, Germany, Norway, Portugal, Sweden, and Canada, joined Operation Cathedral and had uncovered over 200 possible members of the Wonderland Club in over 33 countries. On September 2nd, the Wonderland Club was raided by police worldwide. Over 100 members were placed under arrest for their involvement with the club, men and women. In the UK at 5 a.m., 8 members were arrested and their computer data was confiscated. Wonderland ex-member expressed how he felt grief over being caught because all his friends were going to get arrested, and he tells how 6 of his friends committed suicide that night. A German Wonderland member with the screen name Gronky was arrested. He said, quote, "It hit me like lightning. I was suddenly dragged back into the real world. Of course, I'd always been worried about it being illegal and completely immoral, but my obsession had gotten the better of me. The last thing on my mind was arrest." Many of the criminal sentences carried a maximum sentence of 3 years. This led the UK changing their laws to increase the penalties from 3 years to 10. The National Crime Squad in the UK alone was able to seize over 100 computers and files, which required a 7.5-ton truck to transport all the evidence back to headquarters. Worldwide, more than 1,800 computers were seized, as well as over 750,000 different images of child pornography. Audio files were also collected of children being beaten and crying while being tortured, and the sounds still haunt the investigators to this day. With the Wonderland Club being shut down, the investigators had another horrifying yet important job to complete: identifying the 1,263 children traded within the website. Only 17 of them have been positively identified: 1 from Argentina, 6 from the United Kingdom, 7 from the United States, 1 from Chile, and 1 from Portugal. 11-year-old Rui Pedro Teixeira Mendoza, kidnapped on March 4, 1998. Rui Pedro's parents, Manuel and Filomena, were still searching for their abducted child. The last image of him was taken by a photographer in France with his family at Disneyland. This image caused the Portuguese community to believe that Rui was indeed abducted and that Alfonso Diaz had sold the boy into human trafficking, since he was financially struggling. It was a month after the Disneyland photo was taken that Operation Cathedral had started locking down on Wonderland. When Operation Cathedral announced that the Wonderland Club was extinguished, they needed to identify over 1,000 children. when the National Crime Squad confiscated Wonderland member Gavin Seeger's computer, they found sexual abuse images of an 11-year-old boy with the file name Billy. They believed it was, in fact, Rui Pedro. In 2001, after the raid of Wonderland, the National Crime Squad contacted Rui's mother, Filomena, to identify the images of the boy. Manuel and Filomena Teixeira Mendoza confirmed the tortured boy in the pornographic images was their 11-year-old son, Rui Pedro. Filomena recalled the process of reviewing the Wonderland videos and images by saying, quote, "I saw horrible things. Starting at 4 o'clock in the morning, you can see all the pedophiles acting. They would show me children being raped and then taking pleasure in them crying. They were masturbating. I was watching the images to see if any of them were mine, and I got to a point where I couldn't do it anymore." With the positive identification, the police interrogated Wonderland members Gavin Seegers, who had the photos, and Ian Beldock about Rio Pedro in his location. They both denied knowing who or where the photos came from. Now we're all up to date on the story. So Rui was abducted and sold into the dark web child pornography ring, the Wonderland Club, and Rui's images were on Gavin Seeger's computer, and he claimed to have no idea where they originated from. The police got a positive identification from the parents that it was Rui. And you'd think that the Portuguese police would have begun investigating Alfonso Diaz since he was the last person to see Rui, but no. They didn't have enough evidence to hold him, and then they dismissed him as a suspect. So now the community and the parents, they didn't stop trying to find Rui, especially since seeing the Wonderland images, as horrific as they were, they believed that he was still alive. And of course, with all the missing persons cases, people always call in and then they have tips as that they seen the person. And one event happened where Filomena and Manuel were contacted by a man named Jose Dermatosh, who was, at the time, an inmate for fraud. And he was reaching his final months of his sentence, and he was about to be released. So he told police and the family that he knew the exact location of Rui Pedro. And he told investigators that he could go get him back because the person who had him trusted him. And the police made sense of the idea because Jose was about to be free from jail. Why would he lie? He was then provided with an unlimited credit card and was able to get a vehicle to drive to London to get Rui. So when Jose got there, he called Filomena and Manuel and their grandfather and said that I have located your son and I will bring him back soon. However, days went by and there was no communication from Jose, and the police discovered that he fabricated the entire story and he never even left Portugal. So he got arrested for fraud and sent back to prison for 7 more years. Worth it! Fuck's sakes. People, I tell ya. So the family didn't give up, and they were confident that Alfonso Diaz was involved with the abduction. And in 2003, another pedophile ring was uncovered, this time out of a Portuguese orphanage. And a female sex worker claimed to have seen Rio Pedro in and out of this orphanage. So there was a worker who worked at the orphanage, and his job was to transport children to the abusers' houses every day. And that man was charged, and he got the book, and he was charged with over 600 crimes, and he pled guilty. Unfortunately, nothing of Rui Pedro came out of that. So as we can see, the Portuguese authorities at the time, they were not helpful in this case. And in 2007, they were called out publicly by the Portuguese citizens. For everyone who remembers the disappearance of 3-year-old Madeline McCann, she got so much case recognition and funding by the Portuguese authorities that it upset the citizens of Portugal. So I'm not going to go into the Madeline case since that's its own episode entirely. Her family was from the UK and they were on vacation in Portugal. And her parents went to dinner and left their 3 children alone in a hotel room and checked in on them every 30 minutes. When they came back the final time, Madeline was gone and they never seen her since. Her case went worldwide instantly. And Rui's family and the Portuguese citizens, they were very concerned about the Madeline case, but they were deeply hurt that their own children in their own country were not receiving as much recognition and resources from the police as the Madeline McCann case. It's really sad because Philomena, Rio's mother, stated that it wasn't until the disappearance of Madeline that she was aware that Portugal even had a forensics police unit. And that's so heartbreaking. I believe that Rio needs to be recognized since he is sadly now known to the world as the boy who is not Madeline McCann. Like, that's heartbreaking. And there were speculations that Madeline was connected with the disappearance of Rio Pedro into the Wonderland Club, but it has been proven because no images or videos of Madeline were in the Wonderland Club that she was not involved. So that's been proven. Rui Pedro, at this time of the Madeline disappearance, would have been 20 years old, and people were questioning the police why they were not handing out computer age-generated images of what he would look like at 20 years old, rather than the ones of him being 11 that were being circulated, and the police refused to do it. So whoever fucking knows why, they didn't do it. So local artists offered to help the parents by drawing age progression photos of Rui to hand out to the public. And to make this even more tragic, at the same time as the Madeline McCann case, a source reported that a boy in a restaurant seen a broadcast of Madeline being missing, and he turned to a person in the restaurant and said, "I was kidnapped too. I'm from Flamenco and no one is looking for me." The police ignored it and they claimed it was not a good enough lead, and nothing has come of it. So let's get into the suspicious Alfonso Diaz. A new police team was structured in Portugal that believed they could reconstruct the abduction of Rui Pedro by reviewing old case reports and witness statements that were disregarded in the past. On February 11th, 2011, Portuguese crime squad were able to arrest Alfonso Diaz with the aggravated abduction of Rui Pedro back in 1998. 13 years had passed since the crime, and Alfonso still pleaded innocent. The prosecutors took aim at Alfonso as being the last person who was seen with Rui and had been acting suspicious with witnesses in the park prior to the abduction. Alfonso began expressing how he felt like he was the victim, and none of the evidence proved that he took Rui. He claimed that all the witness statements were inconsistent. It was in November of 2011 when the trial for 33-year-old Alfonso Diaz commenced. Alfonso attempted to get psychiatric evaluation since he claimed that he had no cognitive reality of time. This was denied. After a long trial, Alfonso Diaz was acquitted of all charges involving the abduction of Rui Pedro. In 2014, Alfonso Diaz was retried and sentenced to 3 years in prison for forcing Rui to have sexual relationships with sex workers, but not responsible for the disappearance. He is now currently a free man, living with his wife and child. Rui Pedro has been missing for 24 years and was declared legally dead in 2019. Now, in March 2022, Rui Pedro would be 35 years old. Although the Wonderland Club has been shut down, former member David Hines, when questioned about the idea of children possibly wanting sex and torture on a site being abhorrent, the ex-member casually responded, quote, "Not to us. Wonderland Club Gary Salt was considered a hero and was standing up for what the group believed in. We just didn't see it as abuse. We saw it as there were some children involved in relationships." That is the true story of Rui Pedro and the Wonderland Club. He is still missing to this day, and hundreds of children have not been identified. It's disgusting. Try watching the interviews with the former members of the group, and I wanted to pull my hair out. They're so ignorant and so oblivious to the harm that they were causing. And in the 90s, that was the largest known pedophile ring. And there are way more out there right now. However, I wanted to start the dark web trafficking cases with the original case. So I will do more cases that involve the dark web and trafficking later on, but I'll calm down for a bit. I think the awareness is really important to not ignore that they exist. So Gary Salt, the chairman of the Wonderland Club, he was released in 2010 and he was caught the next fucking day looking at child pornography in a public library in a chat room. Like, how fucking dumb are you? Just saying. And police, they continue to study these images for details that will help them track where the pictures or the videos were made of the children from the Wonderland Club, and investigations may have stopped the group distributing images, but their organization and the sexual abuse remains under investigation.
There'll be more, many more. They're coming for me now. And then they'll come for you.
This week on our never-ending quest to find a scary movie is on a realistic psychological level. It is the 2011 thriller We Need to Talk About Kevin. And I'll flat out say it, it starts off as a semi-slow burn, but it picks up speed once the plot unravels, and this woman's son is a psychopath. The plot involves a woman who gives up her life of freedom to marry a man and have children. And the mother is played by Tilda Swinton, and she cannot bond with her child to save her life, who grows up to become clinically insane. And the son, named Kevin, is played by Ezra Miller, and he plays the Flash in the DC movies. And the father is played by the phenomenal John C. Reilly. He's usually in Will Ferrell movies, but he's really good at serious acting. And that movie, We Need to Talk About Kevin, fucked me up. I recommend it. So if you don't want children, then this movie will only give you more reason to not have children. Like, I don't want kids. And after I watch that, I'm like, you know what? When somebody asks why I don't want kids, this is it. This is it. The YouTube horror short is Guest. And it is recommended by the creators that you watch it in the dark, full screen with the volume maxed. So good luck out there, bud. And I will link the video in the episode description. So please rate and review Lullaby on Spotify, Apple, Google, Amazon Music, and Audible. And follow on social media like Twitter, YouTube, Slasher, at Lullaby the Fear Podcast. So thank you for listening to this week's Lullaby. Sweet dreams. Lights out.